This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarterbin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will often select at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 115th episode of the Quarterbin Podcast, we're looking at Cobalt number 14 from the Milestone imprint of DC Comics, cover dated July 1995. At least according to the cover, because the indicia on the inside says it's August 1995, but I'm sure that's just a minor technicality. But first, a little feedback. The great Kansan Greg Arujo replied to my posting of the Blood Syndicate episode by posting some of the Blood Syndicate house ads, because that's exactly what Greg does. Sir Martin of Grey reported that he had listened to this episode just about as soon as it came out, and I can thoroughly recommend it, he says. Thank you, Sir Martin. And this came in from Matt Moore from Comics with Kenobi. Now, this was a fine example of the 1990s era comics in a nutshell, though not surprisingly, it seemed this issue valued actual story in addition to a bit of the old ultra-violence. Enjoyed very much your breakdown and synopsis. Like you, I was intrigued enough to wonder out loud at the conclusion of the podcast, I wonder what happened in the second issue. I'll have to check my local shops and see if there's a copy to be had in the quarter bin. I wish you luck on that noble quest, Matt. And I heard from good friend of the network, Nathaniel Wayne, who never says anything negative, in an email titled, Oh for Crying Out Loud. Uh-oh. I think this might be the buzzkill version of Nathaniel. He is responding to a comment from, I believe it was Old School Ross, who was bragging about the quarter bins that he had found in Maine, and I commented that those were about the only quarter bins I'd ever heard of in New England. Well, maybe not exactly, because Nathaniel asked, why are you calling me and Ryan and others out by name to alert me of an LCS with a quarter bin located in Maine when there's one here in Burlington, Vermont, Earth Prime Comics, that I've tweeted to you about? Twice, Professor. Is information only filed away into your long-term memory if it arrives in an email form? Do you not appreciate the importance of Twitter, the most vibrant and well-informed bastion of pure entertainment that the world has ever known? The Commander-in-Chief would be very disappointed. #sad. Well, Nathaniel, first of all, I do deeply apologize. I have just heard from very many people in New England that there are not cheap bins to be found. So the fact that you've mentioned it once or twice on Twitter just went over my head. #I'm sorry. And note to self, remove Nathaniel Wayne from the list of candidates for 2018 Listener of the Year. Paul Heeks of the brand new DCOCD podcast wrote in to say that he was excited to see that the Quarterbin podcast had reached an important milestone. Evidently, in Australia, bad jokes go down the drain the other direction. Likes and retweets and shares for that episode came from the generous souls that I've already mentioned, as well as Old School Ross. Both Paul Heeks and Mike Garvey of the Waiting for Doom podcast, Jared West, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, David Foster, Gene Hendricks from The Hammer Strikes, Mike Peacock of Justice's First Dawn, Robert Ludwig, the blog Roots of the Swamp Thing, Mike Morgan, Chris from Bat Books for Beginners, Tim Price, and Laurel at Mountain Flower One. thank you for all that response. Very much appreciated. And now, let's get to today's issue. Cobalt, number 14, at a cover price of $2.50, meaning I acquired this comic at a very easy-to-calculate 90% discount. The cover, by Eric Battle and John Ceballero, shows a grimacing dude with long, flowing, reddish, light brown hair, with a harpoon gun sort of thing in one hand, and chains wrapped around one of his arms. In case you didn't believe me when I said that this was a book from 1995, this cover is definite proof. I'll talk in a little bit about my confusion about who exactly this guy on the cover was. Spoilers, it's Cobalt. But the grimace, the gun, the chain, it's just so generically 1990s. Down the left side of the cover, we have a few bulleted items. Beginning an exciting new era of milestone magic. And, as the city of Dakota trembles on the brink of a riot, Cobalt grapples with what may turn out to be his final challenge. And, 32 fully painted pages in our all-new Milestone 100 premium format. I did check, and the first 12 issues of Cobalt were priced at $1.75. Last month, last issue, that went to $2.50, the price that this one is at. We'll talk about the price increase in a little bit, but those details don't really matter to the quarter bins now, do they? The story, Glass Houses, was written by John Rossum, with art by Eric Battle, Robert Chiano, and Russ Seaver. We start with a recap page, an honest-to-gosh recap page. As primarily a DC reader, I don't know what to make of this strange thing, but it was very helpful in letting me know that Cobalt strikes fear into the heart of Dakota's underworld, especially the criminal organization of Milton St. Cloud. But things went bad for Cobalt when he was forced to take on a teenage sidekick named Paige. Cobalt has discovered that Glass, a man hired by St. Cloud to kill a busload of schoolchildren, may be willing to testify. And now he is battling Rabid, a wild animal of a hitman. Also, Harvest, a former sidekick of Cobalt, wants to eliminate Glass as well, as a way of hurting the St. Cloud criminal organization. Again, if you weren't sure what decade this book was published in, I give you Cobalt, Rabid, Harvest, even Page and Glass. The actual story starts with Harvest suiting up in a full-coverage suit of red, blue, and gold, and a really, really big gun, and a smaller gun, too, and a backpack, and the pouches. Oh, my word, the pouches. And then he rushes to take off all that armor because he has to go to the bathroom. No, really. At the mall, the teen sidekick Paige is bummed because Cobalt is standing him up. They had some mentorship time planned, a bro date of some type. I bet Icon never does this to Rocket, he thinks. He gets in line to watch a movie, and the girl at the ticket booth is Michelle, upon whom he has a major crush. I don't think she can see the hearts swirling above his head, but maybe she does, because she gives him his ticket for free, and briefly, their hands touch. Meanwhile, back in the 90s, Cobalt is tracking Harvest, because he's probably better at finding Mr. Glass than Cobalt is himself. It looks like I made the right decision, he narrates, as Harvest attacks a couple of dudes involved in a drug deal. Cobalt laments that this isn't how they used to do things. We never used to kill. I still don't. He thinks about the problematic fates of many of his former sidekicks and hopes the same doesn't happen to young Paige. Back at the movie theater, Paige is heading through the lobby on his way out, hoping to see Michelle again, and she's still there. They talk about the movie, and he says maybe they should see it together sometime. And Michelle seems to agree to that. Now Paige overanalyzes every sentence the girl has uttered. While he works up the courage to ask her to let him maybe walk her home, her tough guy boyfriend shows up. "Get out of here before I kick your butt," he tells Paige. And as he walks off with Michelle, he asks her about what she was doing talking to that dweeb, adding, "What did I tell you about doing stuff like that?" As the Dakota Police Department learns that Glass has info that they can't access because of some high-level security clearances, Harvest tracks down where St. Cloud is hiding Glass. Unless Cobalt acts fast, he'll be short one witness. Cobalt needs Glass alive. But Harvest, not so much. Glass is not that happy being protected by St. Cloud, and he tells his guards so. St. Cloud's got us sitting here in the middle of nowhere so he can send someone to snuff us. When one of the guards leaves the room, Glass convinces the other two to get rid of that first guy, and then the three of them can escape. But they don't get the chance, as with a whoosh and then a thoom, Harvest fires some big old missile-like projectile into the safe house, and it goes up in flames. "If I lose Glass to that psycho," Cobalt says, before rushing in. Over the next three or four pages, just trust me, there are a lot of bullets fired. There are lots of knives slashing at people. And in the end, two of those three guards are dead, and it's just Harvest and Glass, one-on-one. "Don't feel so tough now, do you?" Cobalt's former sidekick asks. "How does it feel to be afraid?" Glass tries to talk back tough to the guy with the big guns, but that doesn't actually go so well. But before Harvest can take him out, let this be a lesson, monologuing never works. He gets wrapped up in Cobalt's chains, and his gun gets yanked away. "I need him alive," Cobalt says. "You try that again, and you go first," Harvest tells him. Cobalt tries talking sense back into his former partner. If he talks, it could finally put St. Cloud behind bars where he belongs. But Harvest doesn't have as much trust in the judicial system as Cobalt seems to, assuming that the crime lord probably has a ton of cops and probably a few judges on the payroll. And also, where St. Cloud belongs is in hell. They again get into it about superheroes not killing, but Cobalt's logical argument has one major flaw. "You're right," Harvest tells his former mentor. "Superheroes don't kill. But I'm not a superhero." Cobalt yells, "No!" And then from outside the house, we see one of the bodyguards escape, and we hear a single gunshot. Then on the last page, we find ourselves back in the high-rise offices of Milton St. Cloud. The bodyguard has called, and St. Cloud is confident. "It looks like we can relax," he tells his head of security, at least his head of security for the moment. Harvest has taken care of our Mr. Glass problem. St. Cloud then fires his security chief and introduces the new team, gesturing to really just another generic goatee dude in a battle suit, this one shades of red, and a huge ape man ape sort of thing. And St. Cloud proclaims, "Meet Crimson and Man-Eater." The end.
Black Canary, is your hand okay?
No, it's broken, but my heart is mended knowing that we got Rico into a safer home.
Indeed. I can't believe that he was able to survive suicide slums all by himself.
Oracle, let's make sure he has the best birthday ever. Ashford, you want to go in with us on a gift?
I don't do birthdays.
What do you mean you don't do birthdays?
I'm tired of birthdays already.
How can you be tired of birthdays?
Every time I look up, someone is having a birthday, Black Canary. And they just can't have one birthday. It's always, my birthday is on Tuesday, but the party is on Saturday, but my parents are coming in on Sunday, so we're having the dinner on Friday. By the end of the week, according to the logic of birthdays, the person has aged 5 years. Dude, birthdays gotta stop.
If the birthday stopped, that means the person is dead.
I think that's existential.
Subscribe to Feathers and Foes on iTunes. Follow Feathers and Foes on Twitter at Feathers and Foes and email at the Feathers and Foes website.
And we're back. First, a confession. Last episode, I commented that I had and read every issue of the first wave titles of Milestone. And that's true. But among the second wave, I didn't pick them all up. I did read Zombie, that's X-O-M-B-I, because 90s, and it was fine, and I read Shadow Cabinet, and I really liked that one. It's possible I read an issue or two of Cobalt at the time, but I doubt it. I clearly had no recollection of the character, because when I saw the guy on the cover with the Ultimate Warrior mask and the big gun, the guy was clearly not an African-American. Kind of figured he was the villain, because I didn't remember there being any title characters in Milestone who were anything but African-American. And it wasn't until about halfway through the reread of this issue that I got all of that sorted out in my mind, because there weren't any African-Americans in this book at all, at least of substance, and I admit, that surprised me. That's why I don't think I read any Cobalt back in the day. I just think I would have remembered that little fact, that important distinction from the rest of the Milestone books. Now, last episode, I did talk about having to think about Milestone as a diverse comic company, not just an African-American imprint, and we'll actually, in a few minutes, look at Milestone's own statements on that fact. But the fact is, I made that simple mistake when I picked up this issue. So, that's kind of embarrassing. Now, as far as the issue itself, there were a few things that worked for me. The moments between Paige, the geeky teenage sidekick, and the girl at the ticket booth was not bad at all. The internal monologue was very believable. The doubt, the second-guessing of it all. It was a cute scene, and it worked. And then the presence of the loser boyfriend. That was a good touch, too. In terms of wanting to know where the story went after this issue, this was the bit that interested me the most. And Paige had the one funny moment of the issue, the line about Rocket and Icon. I'm not counting the running to the bathroom part as funny, because it was supposed to be, but to me, no. There was definitely story potential in the disparate histories of Cobalt's former sidekicks, one that has turned into a much more hardcore Punisher type of character in Harvest, some references to others that have had bad things happen to them too, and then this teenage kid. I mean, if we plotted it, it sounds like Cobalt may have had worse luck with sidekicks than Batman's had. Now, that recap page gave me some important info about this, which was good because the story itself did not have as much. But it didn't really get beyond the very basic level when there was potential for a lot more exploration of that theme, of that topic. Same with the killing or not killing thing. That's a pretty fundamental life choice. And maybe it got more pages in prior issues, but in this one, that really important distinction between our hero Cobalt and Harvest is glossed over, I think, pretty quickly. But I have to remember, this was the 90s, and long debates were not what comic books were about in the 90s. But comparing this one to last episode, Blood Syndicate number 1, that book was from the 90s too. But it gave us a range of characters, different looks, different personalities. It did give us discussion and debate. And it did all of that while also delivering a nicely exciting action story. Maybe it really is the difference of the 27 months or so between those two issues that the 1990s, quote-unquote, of 1993 and the 1990s of 1995 really are that different. Or maybe it's just the difference between Dwayne McDuffie and Ivan Velez versus John Rossum. Like I said before, there were a few things that I liked in this. They were pretty few and far between. For one thing, there just wasn't a lot happening in this issue, not much of substance at least. There's a question asked at the end. We don't see the body of Mr. Glass, so we don't know whether he was actually shot by Harvest. But here's the problem. I don't really care all that much about getting that answer. He wasn't a compelling character, at least in this chapter of the story. He didn't look or act distinctive. Nothing about him stood out to me. I didn't always keep him straight from his bodyguards when they were in a group shot together. So maybe he's dead. Maybe he's not. For me, I'm kind of meh about that. I did mention that more than 2 years have passed since Blood Syndicate No. 1. For context, Milestone is about 75 to 80% of the way through its lifespan at this point. Cobalt has only 2 more issues left after this one, and the whole line is gone 3 or 4 or 5 months after that. And if this was representative of the line at the time, at this point here, towards the end of it all, I can kind of see why. There was just so much stuff in this book that didn't appeal to me, including the bathroom bit after Harvest had gotten his suit on. I may have mentioned that more than once, but come on. And that's my overall feeling about this issue. Missed opportunities and some underwhelming creative choices made. Now, I did want to mention the 2-page editorial pieces that appear in this issue. About 10 pages in is The Company Line, Milestone's direct communication with their readers, their version of bullpen bulletins and Stan's soapbox. In honor of the 150th issue of the Milestone Line being released this month, they go over on this page a bit of the history of Milestone. Dennis Cowan and Derek T. Dingle meeting in elementary school while McDuffie was growing up in Detroit. And in this piece, Milestone is described as, quote, a multicultural, multi-experimental think tank owned by African Americans, unquote. I like that, and I wish I had that in mind when I was putting together last episode and this one too. The piece also had this take on the concept of diversity. Quote, diversity doesn't stop at ethnicity. Diversity means different backgrounds, different experiences, different worldviews, unquote. And that's a cool, interesting take. This page also does address the price increase, blaming increased paper costs, but also talking about their improved paper stock and printing process. They also announced a program whereby every month, one Milestone comic would be priced at 99 cents. So that would have been good news. As you know, we're a little sensitive around here to the price of comics. And by the way, I did go back and flip through my copy of Blood Syndicate No. 1, the book we covered last episode, and this one, Cobalt 14, is indeed on slightly better quality paper. I mean, I didn't think they were lying or anything, but I did just want to confirm that statement. There are also 2 pages at the end of the issue that discuss the new coloring process that they promoted on the front cover. This is a text piece that also contains some photos explaining the color process and the actual Milestone employees involved in that process. The main thing I learned from this was that there's no doubt that computerized, digital coloring is a huge convenience, a major step forward for the comics industry. What they were talking about in the, quote, new and improved process that they were talking about in that piece was still very confusing, very convoluted, and that was a huge advance over the really old school coloring process used from the 1940s and onward. Now, I would definitely prefer to have a few pages like this than house ads or other kind of advertising, as long as you're not cutting story pages. I liken pages like this to DVD extras, and I love DVD extras. But when the DVD extras are the best part about the DVD, There has been a resurgence of interest in Milestone the last couple years. They've been in the geek news a little bit, so I wanted to talk about that here. Now, about 7 years ago, Dwayne McDuffie, one of the four founders of the company, passed away. And that did seem to put the brakes on any major attempts to reintegrate the Milestone properties into the DC universe. Now, that being said, Static Shock was a title in the New 52, but despite being a well-known character because of his successful animated series, that book only lasted 6 issues. That was in the very first round of New 52 cancellations. And to the best of my knowledge, no other Milestone character has been a major part of a DC book since. Although, Icon and Rocket did appear in the animated series Young Justice. According to Wikipedia, not a primary source, one of the co-founders, writer Reginald Hudlin, discussed a relaunch of Milestone Media Group in a January 2015 interview, along with surviving co-founders Cowan and Dingle. The following July, DC announced the creation of Earth-M within their multiverse, which would be home to the earlier Milestone characters as well as new ones, and that one or two Earth-M titles would be published annually, as well as miniseries and one-shots. That was in 2016, and no further developments took place until late 2017, when it was announced that Milestone would be returning in 2018 with 5 titles, including a Icon and Rocket series, a new Static series, Duo, based on the character Zombie, and 2 other new titles, Earth-M and Love Army. Again, this is back to me, not Wikipedia. But I have no idea about the status of those efforts. And in comics, as much as they like to promote things in advance, to promote new titles, big events, get things in preview so far in advance, I haven't heard anything about Milestone books or characters appearing in 2018. Please correct me if I'm wrong. If you are curious about the history of Milestone, its rise and fall, the characters involved, by characters I don't mean the fictional heroes that were created, I mean the actual human beings who created them. Those guys were all characters. Anyway, the documentary show on AMC, Robert Kirkman's Secret History of Comics, did an episode on Milestone. Season 1, Episode 5, The Color of Comics, included archival footage from back in the day, news stories, interviews, Comic-Con panels and events, that sort of stuff, in addition to recent interviews with the surviving founders and others, looking back on the line and the company with a few decades of hindsight. Again, very interesting program, including what appeared to me at least to be some self-sabotaging behavior by McDuffie and some of the others involved. Really, an interesting look at a very interesting event or moment or time in comic book history. That episode is available on AMC's website, amc.com. At least it was when I checked putting together the notes for this episode. And if I remember, I'll post a link to that in the blog post for this episode. I do recommend it if you're interested in the Milestone line, but this is not a TV review podcast. It's a comic review podcast. And the verdict on Cobalt 14, you may have noticed that I spent a lot of time talking about things other than this book in the analysis portion of this episode. And that's because this one just lacked a lot of the spark that so many of the Milestone books had. This was much more of a generic 90s comic than a distinctively Milestone comic, if that makes sense. And whatever questions were asked or plot points left hanging, to be honest, I don't need to know those answers. And thus, this hardly ever happens. But I don't think this is worth a quarter. I hate saying that, but it just was not good. And that bummer of a verdict wraps up my coverage of Cobalt 14, bringing episode 115 of the Quarterbin podcast to a close. And my original thought in doing these two episodes here was that this would end my milestone coverage, and that this would be another dead universe that I was done with. But as I was reading this issue and then thinking about it and making notes, I really didn't want to end with this. We're not rolling right into another milestone book, but I'm also not closing the book, so to speak, on the line either, like I've done with the Ultraverse, the New You, Amalgam, and a few others. There are still a few milestone books in the Quarterbin database, and I'll keep my eyes open for a few more. At some point, maybe a year from now, maybe two, just maybe, we'll head back to Dakota, back to Milestone. And I certainly hope and expect better issues than this one turned out to be. So, on next episode, episode 116, we're heading back to our celebration of Jack Kirby, here in the centennial year of his birth. And we are heading pretty late in his career, actually, when he was in his early 60s, which actually does not sound nearly as old to me as it once did. All that being said, we will be looking at Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers, issues 1 through 3, from Pacific Comics, cover dated November 1981, January 1982, and March 1982. If you have any questions or comments about this issue, the episode, Milestone, 90s comics, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the Quarterbin. The Quarterbin podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening. Professor!